Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lori Wagner, a member of the club's LGBT Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Tori Osborne. Tori Osborne has been an LGBT activist for 40 years, one of the leaders of the women's movement. She later headed the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force and the LGBT Center of LA. Her tenure at the LGBT Center was during the height of the AIDS epidemic, where under her leadership, the center dealt not only with the AIDS crisis, but achieved gender and racial parity. And recently, she was one of the architects of the highly successful Courage campaign. While I could easily spend another half an hour listing her accomplishments, to quote one journalist, she has some major LGBT advocacy street cred. Beyond our LGBT borders, so to speak, she's headed the nationally renowned Social Change Foundation, Liberty Hill, and served in L.A. Mayor Villaraigosa's cabinet, now continuing to serve as his advisor while working as a senior strategist for United Way and the California Endowment to expand community engagement. Concerning the nature of her work beyond the LGBT community and the world at large, Mayor Villaraigosa is quoted as having said to her, "You and I are alike. Your political home is the LGBT community, but you're a progressive first. My home is the Latino community, but I'm a progressive first. We care about everyone, not just our own communities." She's a visionary coalition builder, and it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to her.
Can you can't see me if I'm up here, can you? All right, I'll try to do this, but I'm Irish, I like to stand. All right, I'm going to try this. I may need to jump around. I titled this talk, "Violets Breaking the Rock, Thoughts on Social Change in the Age of Obama." My title comes from a gorgeous quote from Tennessee Williams that I recently heard. "The violets up in the mountain are breaking the rock." I want to thank Lori Wagner for inviting me to do this. As one of my mentors, a beautiful AIDS activist who died of the disease, and tranny leader Connie Norman used to say, "I love the Bay Area. You just swing your purse and you hit a progressive." I lived in San Francisco between 1978 and 1982, mostly at 24th and Valencia, above the Artemis Cafe, around the corner from Hollinear's Redwood Records, where I worked, right smack in the lesbian feminist half of the San Francisco gendered 70s. You know, the vibrant lesbian activist world you did not see in the movie Milk. I start by observing that we are in the most contradictory and challenging moment that I have ever witnessed in over 40 years of activism. A massive global economic restructuring and contraction, and the start of an era of change that in America came about because of an uprising of democracy, the likes of which I've never seen in my lifetime. It's a new era. We're at a hinge point in history, as Pastor Rick Warren has said. And we're at a place where, once again, as in 1969 with Stonewall, in the middle of America's last progressive era, the LGBT community's story is joining together with the larger American story. Prop 8's passage and California's marriage equality movement play a starring role. Let's face it. America has always had a divided nature. Her story is an ongoing struggle between her sunny and shadow sides. This is a story I understand in my bones. Let me explain. I'm a State Department brat, born in Copenhagen, Denmark, right after World War II. My earliest memory is poring over a cloth children's book showing Denmark's King Christian jauntily strutting down Copenhagen's main street, thronged with people sporting the yellow Star of David. Everyone else in this colorful picture book had a star on as well, and I remember being transfixed by this image, so much so that I cut out a yellow paper star and wore it everywhere and organized all of my playmates to do it as well, as we played in the streets in my family's modest row house. King Christian set the bar pretty high as an example of leadership. Somehow, even at a young age, I internalized the power of collective action for justice. I was proud to live in the single European country that had risen up en masse to save nearly every one of its Jewish citizens when the Nazis occupied Denmark, smuggling families onto fishing boats to safety in Sweden. In my child's memory, Copenhagen is light and bright. Indeed, in every social study, Denmark still ranks as the happiest country on earth. By contrast, a few years later, my dad was transferred to Spain under General Franco and fascism. The world whose values I only later articulated but felt deeply at an early age, social solidarity, individual freedom, economic equality, was upended, replaced by Franco's militarism and stark economic inequality. We lived literally behind a four-story wall in a large corner house in Madrid. We had a nanny, and I was not allowed outside without her. When we went for a walk in the neighborhood, I was accosted by children begging. Pesetas, por favor, are the first words of Spanish that I heard. I experienced the isolation and pain of class inequality from the privileged side. Franco's guns, Las Armas de Franco, patrolled every street corner. My most vivid memory of 2 years in Madrid in the mid-1950s was witnessing a food riot. One day, my brother and I and our nanny turned a corner on the way to our local park and suddenly saw a crowd of people not 100 yards away explode into chaos. Screaming and gunshots split the air as a protest by women and children turned into a brutal melee. We raced home in terror. I will never forget the outrage that I felt and the feeling of powerlessness. A large part of my life's journey has been defined by that contrast between Copenhagen and Madrid, imprinted at an early age. I recoil or rage at injustice. I know true leadership is that which puts power in service of justice. I smell fascism and fundamentalism and creeping militarism. I lean toward democracy. So needless to say, I was a sitting duck for the social movements of the 1960s. Perhaps I would have been anyway, but all I know is that as I saw and watched Birmingham's Bull Connor order police dogs and fire hoses in the spring of 1963 to attack those American children, I felt that moral outrage again. At 12, it was like I re-experienced those ugly days in Madrid. I believe at that moment I felt the first stirrings of the calling that has determined my life. The following year, 1964, I begged my parents to send me to Freedom Summer when white Northern students went south by the hundreds to help register black voters. But I was only 13, and there was no way. From high school on, the struggles that grew from the inspiration of the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War, just in case you didn't know, anti-Vietnam War, student movement, the anti-racism and poverty movements became my own life's focus. And of course, then with feminism and lesbian feminism and gay liberation, the personal and political merged. Here's my point, though. Within the course of my own lifetime, I feel as if I have traversed one way and then been dragged the other on America's jagged journey toward justice. That is, after the empowering and exciting tumult of the 1960s and 70s, for much of the past two decades, even while we have advanced the LGBT movement phenomenally, Most intensely under the past 8 years of Bush, I have had the unsettling experience of flashing back to Spain in the 1950s, feeling like a menacing Franco-like spirit was invading America's, pervading America's political economy. An anti-democratic system of concentrated power and privilege, economic apartheid, and growing militarism that has felt hegemonic. And I've experienced the old familiar feelings of powerlessness. And now, once again, I feel I'm seeing the sunlight of enlightened leadership tilting toward equality that gives my Danish imprinted American heart hope. The violets are blooming once again. But let's look a little more at the rock. Because only by understanding what we're up against will we be able to crack it open to the sunlight of America's promise. As I mentioned, this country has always been a divided nation with its two competing stories, the gospel of wealth versus the American dream, genocide, slavery and racism, imperial arrogance versus America's higher self, the beacon of democracy, those precious words on our founding documents. These two sides have quarreled over the right to patriotism from the start. And only through periodic waves of progressive social movements has America advanced on that promise of ever-expanding democracy. Abolitionism and suffragism, the labor movement, the civil rights movement of the 1960s that inspired so many others to step out and claim a place at the human rights table. Women, gays and lesbians, Chicanos, Asian Pacific Islanders, the disabled, transgender folks, new immigrants, and more. Bay Area psychologist and law professor Peter Gable, writing in Tycoon magazine in an article actually about gay marriage a couple years ago, says, the only power that can defeat fear is the power of love itself, expressing itself in a social movement of humanity. And that social movement, when it arises, as it repeatedly has done throughout history, by its own presence, tends to emulsify fear. As it touches within good-hearted people everywhere that secret hope that a loving world is possible, that hope that has in the past turned into what Gable calls the erotic basis of the legal and policy reforms of the New Deal, the Great Society, the civil rights movements, all the social movements that have been able to employ power in service of love. Now, it's only recently that I've realized how radical and rapid fire the progressive change that came to America the last time around between 1960 and 1975. Only 15 years. It's the blink of an eye. Civil rights challenging long-entrenched racism, the feminist revolution, gay liberation, and environmentalism. These were profoundly new ideas. And America is conservative. I've come to realize this in middle age. It changes, but it changes slowly. And in a convulsive backlash to the 1960s, America's shadow side reemerged with a vengeance. I share this history because this time around, if we want to build lasting progressive movement that's powerful enough to really break the rock and change politics and policies and public opinion, we must do it differently. Anyway, rising again, maybe we can talk more about that later. Anyway, rising again after the ignominious defeat of Barry Goldwater in 1964, the American right wing, always a facet of this country, had the audacity to declare smack in the middle of the left-lurching 1960s that they would take power again in 20 years, and they did. They systematically built the most powerful social movement of our era. There's a large literature documenting this. They learned from previous progressive movements on our side, unified their own single-issue movements, anti-tax, pro-gun, later conservative religious Christian evangelism, and astonishingly, they beat their own timetable by 4 years with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 and thus began a rolling coup that lasted until this past year. I know, Bill Clinton gave us respite. But we can't forget he carried the right's water on criminal justice and welfare reform, not to mention Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the Defense of Marriage Act, because the right wing, the conservative movement, was so powerful he had no choice. Before the 1970s, the right was just as fragmented as progressives have become since the 1960s. They had to transform, and they did. They knew after the moral power of the civil rights movement that the mainstay of their ideology, previously alongside free enterprise fundamentalism, racial segregation would no longer work in America. So they built popular support around a different culture war, anti-feminism, and then later anti-gay rights. They tapped into people's deep-seated fears about so much change so quickly, especially at home with the growing independence of women and what I would call the democratization of the American family. In 1965, 70% lived in the traditional nuclear family of one man, one woman, and kids. By 2025, it will be 7%. In the LGBT community, we have been well aware of the radical right's homophobia and even its connection to the backlash against women's rights, but we have completely underestimated the importance of the other aspect of the right-wing revolution of the past 30 years, economic inequality, in the context of a globalizing restructuring of the economy. 30 years ago, the right set out to reverse the fiscal political policies of the Great Society and the New Deal that had created rising economic equality from the 1940s through the 1970s. Their strategy was crafty, to smother the American dream by starving government. Free market fundamentalist conservatives made it their goal to starve the beast of government using budget deficits via tax cuts to force reductions in social services. They knew what the rest of us seemed to forget, that government is the delivery system for equal opportunity through public education and social programs. By undermining faith in government, crippling it through tax cuts, as well as attacking liberalism as an idea, the right reversed a 30-year trend toward greater equality. I always travel with this chart. Will you just pass them around? Add their bellicose policies. This chart is from the United for a Fair Economy, www.ufe.org. They do popular education on economics, and they have a wonderful slideshow you can just download. But this is the one chart that tells the story of the radical shift in the last 30 years, and how the 40 years previously all boats rose, and that in the last 30 years only the boats at the top have risen. And it still holds, even with the recession and the loss of 30% of the aggregate wealth of the country. Add to this the bellicose policy positions of the right on defense and crime fighting, and we see today what has been built in America: unending war and militarism, harsh. Now you have to listen to me. You got to look at the chart later. Okay, it's bedtime reading. And we see what has been steadily built in our beloved country: unending war and militarism, harsh criminal justice policies, and over-incarceration at the state level, and prioritizing public safety over everything else at the local level, maybe not in San Francisco, but in Los Angeles. I can vouch for that. The ROC is huge and powerful. The forces of inequality arrayed against us little violets, who insist on equality, mutual connectedness, and responsibility for the earth, are still in place, the forces of equality. Look at what Obama is up against. Our work has just begun this time around. Now, I just have to give a few more economics facts. This is my soapbox. It'll only take a couple of minutes. America has seen the most rapid, greatest upward transfer of wealth from the middle class and the working class to the wealthy in human history between 1980 and 2005. That's what that chart's about. We were until recently, but with the bonuses that Goldman Sachs will be giving out, we're heading back the other way, in a second American Gilded Age, with economic inequality at 1929 levels. By 2005, the top 1% of 1% of Americans, 300,000 people, have more income than the bottom 150 million. This has doubled since 1980. Middle-class wages are 16% less than in 1973, and 80% of all economic gains on both wealth and income went to the top 1%. The average, we have nearly a million homeless in this country, estimated to increase by 35%, by the way, over the next 3 years. In LA, 50% of households, I don't know the demographics of the Bay Area, but economic demographics, but in LA, 50% of households live on $40,000 a year or less. I don't know how families live on $40,000 a year or less. We have all been steamrolled, over the past 30 years, by a silent juggernaut of economic injustice. Now, because our own LGBT movement has ironically come into visibility and power at the same time, we've been too busy to connect to the core American struggle for economic opportunity as a movement, not individuals. But Prop 8's passage has exposed the fault lines and limits of our movement and forced us to wake up. The same people who brought us Prop 8, a well-organized, well-oiled right-wing machine, are the same people who brought us this bitter economic divide and are the same people who brought us the Three Strikes Law and Prop 187, and as of this week, threaten us with what I call spawn of 187. They're gathering signatures for another redux of Prop 187, the anti-immigrant. In majority-minority California, a state of immigrants and the economic divide, in Los Angeles at last count, we have 240,000 homeless people and 262,000 millionaires, not including the value of their homes. There are 19,000 foreclosures in South LA alone. The LGBT community ignores economic and racial justice at our own peril. I ran LA's Social Justice Foundation, Liberty Hill, for 8 years. I remember one day we visited a church in Watts to learn about one of our grantee partners, the Ex-Offenders Action Network, a brave group of parolees fresh from California's prison system. Ernest, a big, beautiful African-American man, proud of his sobriety and organizing skills in service of others like him who had gone to prison and turned their lives around. 70% of his group's members came out jobless with drug and alcohol issues. 40% are illiterate. Ernest was organizing others like him to put together a social services agency to help them get jobs and into addiction treatment. I had a wonderful conversation with him drawing on my own experience running the LA Gay and Lesbian Center, which if you don't know, it's a one-stop social services agency, and I found I was mentoring this guy in how to do a startup. That night, I went to a GLAAD dinner, Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, as the guest of one of my closest friends, a major donor to GLAAD and to Liberty Hill. There were no less than 3 goodie bags on my chair at our VIP table. They were chock full of jewelry, fancy electronics, a silk scarf, and more. And the MC proudly announced that the retail value of the bags topped $5,000. That was more than Ernest's net worth. The contrast literally made me nauseous. And for a moment, I felt more alien in my gay world than in that church in Watts with black and brown former prisoners. The right has cleverly and deliberately organized within low-income communities of color and rural communities against us, against LGBT people. Please take time to track down and view Dee Mossbacher and Sylvia Rue's brilliant film, All God's Children. It's a little outdated, but it tells the story from the 1980s, outdated in that it was made a while ago. The information stands about how systematically and cynically the right, the same folks who had supported segregation a generation earlier, organized through the conservative black churches against gay people, specifically to drive a wedge in the liberal coalition. Prop 8's passage was the culmination of the right's genius. They put together a perfect grassroots multiracial coalition tapping into the growing hunger for linking together in common purpose across communities. But of course, lies and disinformation ruled about children and churches. Has nothing changed since Proposition 6? Many in communities of color did not know the masterminds were Mormon and the white Christian right together at last. Their movement is not one of racial justice. They use people against other people. But they built on a foundation of class resentment that we must understand. The right's ultimate agenda is inequality of all kinds, not just against us. The culture wars are real, but also a smokescreen that hide that structural economic transformation of this country over the last 25 years, whose better DNA is freedom and economic opportunity. The very same people who brought us Prop 8 are the ones who put the American dream on life support. That is a truth we must better understand as we go forward. Now, our LGBT movement deserves great kudos in this 40th celebration year of the Stonewall riots for its magnificent achievements. In a right-wing era, it has won hearts and minds of this country around homosexuality in Puritan America. I mean, truly, it's an absolutely extraordinary accomplishment in 40 years, what has happened. And I don't mean to belittle it by not focusing on it, by focusing on other issues. We have built and sustained, we may be the only movement in history that has built and sustained an infrastructure of legal and legislative and political and social and spiritual organizations that have steadily passed the torch over 40 years, across generations. But since the last upsurge of activism during the height of the AIDS epidemic, in the middle of the agony of AIDS, in the late 80s and early 90s, our leaders have turned inward and become complacent, unplugged from the grassroots and allies, and been protected by the privilege of a movement funded by that top 20% that has been benefited by the radical changes in the economic rules. And they have become too focused on institution building and not movement building. By 2008, the mainstream of the LGBT movement had become insular. I stand with Dolores Huerta, who said at Camp Courage in Fresno a couple of months ago, "We lost on Prop 8 because our work is not yet done." I hope we talk more about that later. Side note, I'm focusing on LGBT and economic inequality, but there's also, of course, the cry for environmental sanity and life over destruction of the planet and its precious resources. Activist environmentalist Paul Hawken, probably from the Bay Area, that kind of guy, says, "We have an economy that tells us it's cheaper to destroy the earth in real time than to renew, restore, and sustain it, with 50% of the world's species facing extinction if we don't reverse climate change." There are huge stakes here besides what we're talking about tonight. Enter the Obama moment. So I don't know about you, but for the long, dark years of the Bush administration, it felt to me like a spell had been cast in America. But fortunately, occasionally we rise up to take back our country, and we can't be lied to forever. The ring of truth eventually wins out, which is, by the way, one of the reasons why we will win on Prop 8 next time. Barack Obama tapped into, in my view, he did not create it. He tapped into a huge pent-up moral hunger to reverse the greed and individualism and inequality that had steamrolled this country. I, along with some of you at least, I know, felt called last summer to join the Obama Army for Change. I was still actually reeling from a divorce and remembered the lessons from my friends living with AIDS that activism heals. That's why I joined the Obama movement. Now, I had tried to plug into the No on 8 campaign to little avail, but the open source Obama campaign was different, and it frankly blew my mind. The first day that I showed up to volunteer at the office, there were 1,100 other people lined up outside. 1,100 people. And I'd been working in Los Angeles doing progressive activism for 25 years, and I knew one person. In 40 years of social activism, I never felt or seen anything like the intensity of engagement on the part of diverse, everyday people. This was not just a political campaign. This was a social movement. 75% had never been involved before. I felt like I was part of a loving and determined uprising. Now, I was not a leader. I joined a team of mostly women who worked 24/7 organizing Latino and African-American voter-to-voter outreach Los Angeles to Nevada. Pipe fitters with elementary school teachers, young lawyers, retired firemen, Hollywood executives' wives, straight and gay, bi and trans. I've always said the mark of a true social movement is when people are willing to sacrifice personally. And people had taken leave from their jobs. They were being supported by prayer groups from their churches, spouses who never saw them, grandparents from Iowa who pitched in to pay their rent. I've never seen anything like it since the AIDS epidemic in our community. There was the same kind of sacrifice and service, people stepping forward as never before. Our motley crew formed a beloved community, in Dr. King's words. There was a bond of mutual mission and responsibility where political and demographic differences evaporated. I came because of Barack. I stayed because of the people I was working with, which is how movements actually work. Now, I've experienced that egalitarian, empowering movement culture in the 1960s and in San Francisco in the lesbian feminist community in the 1970s, and then in the AIDS epidemic with my lesbian and gay community, but never with everyone, with the full demographic and political spectrum of America. We learned through Camp Obama, largely the leadership training ground for the Obama campaign super volunteers, we learned to talk to people who don't think like us. Better yet, we learned to listen to them. Respect, empower, include was the living mantra of the campaign. A free and democratic space was created that engaged and changed people. It was a most extraordinary revolution of the heart, the power of love expressing itself in a social movement that Peter Gabel talks about is a power that's truly unstoppable. I watched us turn Nevada blue by 12%, an unthinkable political calculation before this campaign. California did that. California volunteers, 790,000 of us, delivered 10 million phone calls, 55% of all of the phone calls to battleground states, turned Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada blue. 4,000 leaders were trained at Camp O. 18,000 people on Election Day alone made 2 million calls. The numbers are totally staggering, and frankly, it's a story that has not been told publicly, claimed the credit. But I think it will change the calculus in California. We can talk about that if you want to. I learned that Prop 8 was going to win from my colleagues on the Obama campaign as they despaired at the omnipresence of canvassers and the proliferation of yellow lawn signs in their neighborhoods in Southeast and South Los Angeles. We were all proud that Barack had come out against Prop 8 within 24 hours of the ballot measure qualifying and despaired that the No on 8 campaign never used that endorsement. When Prop 8 passed, every single one of my straight African-American and Latino fellow Obamaniacs were out in the streets protesting. Every single one. One African-American Obama friend put it this way: I was too busy getting Barack elected to organize my family, and the yes folks got at them. But I'm here now, and I'm not going away. It gives me a lot of hope about next time. Now, Barack community organized his way to the White House by tapping into that fierce moral hunger for a return to America's higher path toward liberty and justice for all. That hunger, from my experience, is not ideological. It does not belong to one party. But it does brush aside some of the culture of identity politics, of individual groups and their tendency for competing victimization, and it poses a challenge to our community's tendency towards single-issuedom. The winning culture of the Obama campaign was a sharp turn from identity politics, and I hope it influences the advocacy and movement building from now on. It emphasized commonality, not difference, e pluribus unum. It emphasized the positive, not the negative, respect and power include. The motto of Yes, We Can is very different from I want my rights too, or I'm more oppressed than you. Just one more word about this, because the Achilles heel of identity politics has been what is cynically called political correctness, the tendency to valorize victimhood. At the very least, identity politics too often enshrines difference to the point of fragmentation. In the LGBT community, as one African-American lesbian friend put it, I'm sick and tired of the endless debate. Am I gay first and then black, or black first and then gay? I'm tired of my humanity being all chopped up. No wonder the relentlessly optimistic world of Yes, We Can felt healing to so many of us from so many minority communities. I hope that the positive new politics grows wildly. Walking the dusty rural roads of Boulder City and suburban Henderson, Nevada for Obama last fall with my longtime friend, Black AIDS Institute Executive Director Phil Wilson, we were astonished to find less racism and homophobia behind those rural and suburban doors, and far more commonality than we expected. The hunger for that commonality was palpable. We joked as we walked that the LGBT community's motto seems to be, no, you can't, or yes, I can. And we decided our friends badly needed a healthy dose of Si Se Puede. So, the community organizer in chief is in the White House, but he needs us to continue organizing. There are more violets in the mountain than ever. The right wing rock is cracking, but a lot of work needs to be done. The systems are entrenched and will take a long time to be uprooted, to mix many metaphors. In 40 years of organizing, I've never seen anything like this time because there's absolutely no roadmap for navigating it, this new historic opening. And that's all that the Obama presidency gives all of us, as Americans, as LGBT people, is an opening. He is dedicated to reversing the tidal wave of inequality, but he can't succeed unless all of us keep doing our job. There is no blueprint. It's up to us to make one. And we'd better do it better than we've ever done it before. We'd better walk through our fear and build another powerful, unstoppable American force for sanity and humanity before it's too late. When the winds of change, a Chinese proverb, so they say, there are lots of amazing Chinese proverbs, but I sometimes wonder if they are Chinese proverbs. But when the winds of change blow hard, some people build a wall and others build a windmill. That's our choice. The LGBT movement institutions, just to talk about that movement for a minute, will stagnate unless the winds of change bring fresh leadership and windmills and volunteer activism. Every movement has life cycle and needs reinvigoration. The new wave of young activists who hit the streets after Prop 8 are in worthy rebellion against the lack of vision of our institutional leaders. They're demanding new ideas, new democracy, new engagement. The uprising that elected Obama has, of course, spread to the LGBT movement, and I embrace this. Unless our movement transforms, we may lose the next ballot measure. And I miss the chance to work side by side in breaking the larger rock with others. How do we take advantage of this window of opportunity? And I want to just give like one quick lesson. I'll try to wrap it up quickly so we can do lots of questions before we can stay past when the radio hour is up. But the most important thing is to continue to build the social movement outside and to work cleverly, as we learned in the AIDS epidemic, with folks who are on the inside. The LGBT people, we tend to want a savior. I remember this well with the Clinton administration. And as my friend Sheila Kuehl says, we fall for them, they disappoint us, then we fall on our faces. Presidents can only open the door. This is very analogous to what we were talking earlier about how similar this is to when Kennedy was elected in 1960. It opened up the space for the civil rights movement that had been being built for years down south to explode beyond the boundaries of the South and become a national movement. That's what Kennedy's election did. Now, I want people to be reminded that Kennedy and RFK actually were decidedly against the March on Washington that Martin Luther King called for in 1963, and that, by the way, Bayard Rustin, gay black man, right hand to Martin Luther King Jr., organized in 6 weeks. 6 weeks, thank you very much, without the internet. So don't tell us we can't be in Washington on October 11th. Anyway, and FDR's experience is quite similar. He actually, people think the New Deal just kind of went in fully cooked. In fact, in his first year, FDR was quite conservative and catering to conservative business interests, and he famously had a meeting with a group of labor leaders and afterwards said, okay, you've convinced me, now go make me do it. And it was 3 years of coalition building and protest between veterans, farmers, the unemployed, and workers that created the coalition, that created the outside pressure that made those wise people such as Francis Perkins, labor secretary, who was a progressive on the inside, be able to have the policy move the New Deal forward. So, and have you been listening to the Justice Sotomayor hearings for just a little sense of the violence against the big rock? Senator Sessions, bye-bye. Anyway, so I have you, you know, or the disinformation on talk radio about health care reform. I hope that I will see some of you or hear of some of you working phone banking and canvassing for health care reform in whatever form you do it. There's some people working with Organizing for America. There are some people sort of working through the single-payer movement here through Henry Waxman's office, very effectively doing some lobbying. I hope that I see you in Washington on October 11th for the National Equality March. You should check out this website, www.nationalequalitymarch.com.org. Try both. I can't remember. It is fabulous. You just sign up, whatever. Find out what congressional district you're in. See who's organizing. It's meant to be an organizing march, much like the LGBT march in 1987 was at the height of the AIDS epidemic. It wasn't just a mingle on the mall. It was an organizing, PFLAG, ACT UP, GLAD chapters sprung up all over the country. This is attempting, with the leadership of Cleve Jones, the Bay Area's own beloved Cleve Jones, I hope you guys love him as much as we do in L.A., to create a national network in all 435 congressional districts using the Obama CD model for organizing and building a grassroots structure that can build the kind of movement outside that can push Obama on our issues. So there's lots of other things to say. I think I'm going to wrap it up because I want to hear some questions, and I've gone a little bit long. I want to end by my favorite recent Barack Obama quote. The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea, passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are created equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue the full measure of happiness. Barack Obama, Inauguration Day, 2009, exactly what part of all remains unclear. We got some work to do. Thank you.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California and that you are listening to The Fierce Urgency of Now, Toward a New American Movement in the Obama Era with Tori Osborne. We'll move on to questions now.
I'm going to just take them in the order that they were given to me. In talking of the history and chronology of the civil rights movement and the growth of the conservative movement, there were many mentions of our side and their side. Isn't that part of the problem? Shouldn't we be trying to find a way to smooth the idea of other? And the answer to that is yes. I do think that one of the reasons why the right was able to organize this amazing movement very quickly was that they listened far better than those of us in our youth, radically barging forward, making change, listened to people's fear of change. We just were young, radical feminists and queers and civil rights warriors and environmentalists, and the movement that we built, really, that 15 years, I mean, this was a revelation for me. And yes, I think that part of one of the great signs of good organizing is listening. It's part of why the Obama campaign was so successful. It is part of what we teach in Camp Courage, part of the methodology, I think. It's what we were talking about Spain. My Spain that I talk about of fascism under Franco has gay marriage, has marriage equality. You know, how did this happen in 25 years? And Lori is an expert on Spain and was actually sharing with me some of the legacy of the civil war in Spain of the 30s was that people learned that they had to listen to each other because they didn't want to have that kind of a civil war again. So I do think this is a sign of an important mark of good organizing is listening. You still get to tell your story, your passionate story, and try to convince them to your side. As of today, Democrats enjoy, question number two, as of today, Democrats enjoy a majority in both Congress and both federal houses. If the LGBT movement is to achieve equality in marriage, should not Obama do so before the next election? Clinton lost his majority in Congress, the first congressional electorate after Clinton was elected president. Now, just historically, I mean, I suppose it is possible that the Republican Party could extract itself from being controlled by its radical right wing, move to the center, and mount some kind of an opposition that could win back majority in Barack's second term. I don't think it's likely. I really don't think it's likely. That doesn't mean he shouldn't move more quickly on don't ask, don't tell, marriage equality, and other issues. I am completely in the camp. But I believe this is our job. I believe we are the ones we have been waiting for, not he is the one we have been waiting for, that our job is to keep putting the pressure on him. And, you know, I'm disappointed with everybody else it's not about campaign promises broken. It's about somebody who I think really believes this, who has not moved fast enough. But then I put together the Oval Office meeting of gay leaders with President Clinton and actually heard our friend, and he was our friend at the time, in April of 1993, tell me that his strategy on lifting the ban on gays in the military was to play golf with Colin Powell and to try to convince him that gay people were good people. I knew we lost right about then. Don't ask, don't tell was as good as it got back then. But it's up to us how hard and how cleverly and how strategically we pressure. We have a lot of friends on the inside. I mean, this is really the trick, and this is a whole other lecture that I learned from being on the inside of the Villaraigosa administration. There are people who play the outside-inside game well, and actually the gay community wrote the book on this in AIDS. We did a brilliant job. We did a brilliant job. That story hasn't been written either, about working people who were on the inside who were friendly and having ACT UP and later Queer Nation and a very militant outside working together. I was on the AIDS Commission in Los Angeles and spoke on a daily basis with the folks that were running ACT UP. We were collaborating, and that's the kind of strategy that you need, people on the outside as well as on the inside. But I don't think the Republicans are going to get a lot of steam soon. So I think Obama has a little room to breathe. We got to keep pressuring him in on our issues. And by the way, healthcare, if he moves healthcare, education reform, and energy, this would go a huge way towards reversing this inequality, this economic inequality. And it's going to take time. Given your brilliant connections between the economic stratification caused by the right, love that, caused by the rise of the conservative era, how do you view the Roman Catholic Church's preferential option for the poor and yet their pivotal role promoting Prop 8 and other anti-LGBT measures? I'm a recovering Catholic. You can never truly completely take the Catholic out of the girl, believe me. My love for pageantry will never die. But truly, this is one of the strangest paradoxes. I actually found out recently, I met with the state director of ACORN, you know, the grassroots organizing group, and I found out that in Oakland, where they're very strong, and in around the Bay Area, I know it was Oakland and other places, ACORN members were going door to door, no on Prop 8, and the statewide ACORN took a position, no on Prop 8, that cost them $300,000 from the Catholic Church's charity arm. And when they found out from their members that every Catholic church, I didn't know this until the director of ACORN tells me this, that every Catholic church was commanded to put a yes on Prop 8 sign in their church. The ACORN members all over the Bay Area fanned out, went to Catholic churches everywhere, took them and hid them in corners. That kind of subversive ally work is fabulous. The Catholic Church traditionally has been really good on poverty. They're good on the death penalty. I mean, good. Okay, I come from a progressive perspective. I understand we don't have political unity in this room. But there are a set of policies that the Catholic Church has just been way out front on social justice, on economic justice issues, on immigrants' rights. In Los Angeles, they are, you know, they're terrific. And then there's women's and gay issues, and they are just impossibly medieval. And, you know, I don't know what to do. I mean, look at what's happened in the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church. They've just split, and then the liberal wing has now just affirmed gay and lesbian bishops. You know, there's like a gay thing a day. Have you noticed this? Yesterday, Bill Clinton comes out for gay marriage. We knew you had it in you, Bill. You know, today the front page of the New York Times is all about the Anglican, I mean the Episcopal. Is it the Anglican? It's called the Episcopal. They think they're Catholics, but they're not. But anyway, so, you know, who's to explain? But, you know, in a conservative era, the, you know, differences become exacerbated. And ironically, the Catholic Church, which is good on the economic and racial justice issues and has been downright heroic, a lot of local parishes, you know, is just reactionary. So, I mean, I don't know what we do. We work with our local, do they still have dignity? You know, we organize. We just keep doing this. And you look for the violets in the rock because they're there. There are parishes run by openly gay priests where the cardinal looks the other way in Los Angeles. There are the violets in the rock, and we just keep hoping those men in high drag who are making laws for women and gays just stop.
Unfortunately, we only have time for one more question.
Okay, there's one more question.
Okay.
There has been a lot of blame passed for eight. Passing. I've also heard those who could have made a difference busy out working for Obama out of state. Guilty not making those few percent changes in California. Yes, and you know, I'm one of them, so I take responsibility. But I want to say, I tried. I tried for 3 weeks to plug in. For 3 weeks, I tried to plug in and I couldn't do it. That's something wrong with a campaign. That's not something wrong with me. When the heat of a campaign, it ought to not take more than one phone call or one email. So there was a systemic, we didn't talk about it here. I'm on record what I think about the campaign. I think it sucked. I thought it was terrible. I think we could have won it. I think it's a travesty. It's political malfeasance. But I think it actually should have won anyway, even with all the young folks, many of the young folks, and people like myself working on the Obama campaign. I don't think you can blame the folks that were working on the Obama campaign for what happened to Prop 8. I really don't. But the good news is, as Dolores Huerta, if you believe in the, you know, sort of karmic truth of Dolores Huerta saying, we lost, they won, because our work was not yet done. We now have had the opportunity to do it differently. And I, you know, if any of you don't know about Camp Courage and are interested in attending Camp Courage, we're continuing to do them across the state. We have some wonderful folks here who have been involved with Camp Courage. There is the new folks into the movement, the allies, both gay and straight, are transforming the marriage equality movement. The work of coalition building is being done so that it will look different next time, and we're going to win. Whether we go in 2010 or 2012, I'm guessing it's going to be 2012 just because of the sense of momentum and money. And anyway, we're going to have to fight Spawn of 187 in 2010, so maybe it's better if we don't go in 2010. But I think there was an opportunity to make a whole lot more violets so that together we could break the rock. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to Tori Osborne, Senior Strategist, United Way of Greater LA, for her comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as our radio audience, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.